Great, so we'll just set that right there. And then, perfect. So, I guess where I figured we would start was getting some like background information on yourself. So, where did you grow up?
Okay. It's like real background information.
Yeah.
I grew up in Warren, Ohio. Northeast corner of mm-hmm. Ohio, kind of between Cleveland and Pittsburgh, pretty much.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, what was it like growing up there in sort of your teenage years and whatnot?
I don't think about it much. I mean, I think it was fine, but, I mean, I wasn't really out in my teen years. I knew, but I wasn't really interested in being out. I was also in, like, the Air Force, mm-hmm. pre-Air Force program, so mm-hmm. My energies were kind of focused elsewhere, so.
Did you end up going into the Air Force, or?
That's how I got to Penn State, so okay. Yeah. So yes and no. I actually never did my active time, but I had, mm-hmm. like, I think 4 years of reserve time.
Mm-hmm.
But I dropped my scholarship right before the enforcement of the active time would have came in, which worked out well, but you know.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So you said you went to Penn State. Is that where you went to college, or
yes. mm-hmm.
what did you do in college, or
what did I do in college? Well, let's see. Well, I got an Air Force ROTC scholarship mm-hmm. For chemical engineering, and mm-hmm. I was doing chemical engineering administration of justice as a dual major mm-hmm. at Penn State. Without actually really any goals for using either of those uh-huh. degrees, I had already started doing nonprofit work at around 14 years old, so mm-hmm. I already knew I was going to continue doing nonprofit work, but I did like mechanical engineering. Chemical engineering was fine, but I chose chemical engineering because it was one of the guaranteed. It was the hardest to get scholarship, but if you qualified for it, it was pretty much guaranteed because the Air Force needed chemical
right.
engineers
mm-hmm.
that period of time.
Yeah.
So it wasn't even my primary interest in engineering. It was just like, you know, it's like, okay, let's just choose this scholarship. But so if I would have stayed, I would have obviously ended up doing some, you know, chemical research and stuff for the Air Force, but outside of, I mean, I hadn't really planned on making the Air Force any type of career or anything
mm-hmm.
like that.
Mm-hmm.
It was really just a way to get to college.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So you said you started doing nonprofit work at 14?
Yeah. So, yeah, the year before I started high school,
mm-hmm.
I got involved with the PIC program, which basically, it was kind of like probably like a low income job creation
mm-hmm.
program for youth. I think it does adults as well, but
okay.
I'm not really that familiar
mm-hmm.
with the adult version
mm-hmm.
of the program. So, but so I started doing that the summer that I turned 14, and then from that I actually started doing some kind of nonprofit programming work
mm-hmm.
at different nonprofits and the library in town and things
mm-hmm.
like that. And that was, you know, by my first year in college, I created my first nonprofit. Well, I shouldn't say I created that one. I actually revived a nonprofit that used to exist but had died like a few years
mm-hmm. yeah.
back in, you know, in the State College area. And, you know, then from there, like the Lesbian Gay Center here
mm-hmm.
and then my current nonprofit. So
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. What was that nonprofit that you started? Could you tell me the story of restarting that up, or?
Oh God, it was It was like it was an HIV AIDS education combination of lesbian gay outreach program at Penn State, in-state college, basically. Mm-hmm. So what had happened, and I think, you know, the IRS rules are a little bit more different now, but pretty much there's, like, you get a 501c3 license, and if you're not filing on the regular basis, or, like, if the organization folds or something like that, the license, it pretty much just elapses, but, mm-hmm. like, unless you actually file a form saying that the organization is officially closed or over, mm-hmm. you still have your 501c3 status, oh, okay. right? Yeah. Like, now the government actually checks on it every few years. So, like, if you don't file, like, a Form 990 in, like, 3 years or something like that, they mm-hmm. automatically pull your status. But then it was kind of like they weren't wasting the resources to check, you know? So I was doing... working in the Women's Center on campus, as well as doing some work with the Lesbian and Gay Student Organization on campus there. I forget what they were called. I think just like the Lesbian and Gay Student Organization or something mm-hmm. like that, mm-hmm. you know. I guess we were doing a fair amount of organizing, like, in social and political aspects, but there was... definitely a growing need for, like, AIDS education and information, and mm-hmm. that resource had pretty much gone. So, it was fairly easy to, like, kind of just revise it as, like, something fairly low maintenance, just mm-hmm. like to kind of publish and distribute information and things like that. But I believe eventually somebody else actually took it over and they started offering other types of services, but, you know. Mm-hmm. I wasn't really into it before that. I mean, I was in school full time and still involved with ROTC, actually, at that point as well. So it's not like I needed it, you know, right?
Yeah. What year was this? Just for, like, the timeline of thinking about
this? I'm really bad with the year, to be perfectly honest.
Okay, that's fine.
I went to Penn State in 86.
Okay.
So it would have been somewhere between 86 and I was going to say probably 86 and 88.
Okay.
I believe, because I think 88 I went to Holland for 6 months or something like that. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So yeah, it would have been, somewhere around there.
So I guess to because I'm interested about some of your first LGBT activism, but I guess to back up before that, did you have a coming out experience, or what was that sort of like for you?
I didn't really, actually. Okay. At least not in, like, the traditional sense. I mean, I think, you know, as I said, I had acknowledged it to myself in mm-hmm. high school, but it wasn't of that. I mean, there wasn't really anyone that I was interested in, or mm-hmm. And I was pretty darn focused on trying to, like, get to college. So it wasn't really a big issue mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. at that point. And then in college, pretty much after my first year, I was just kind of like, okay, I'm going to, like, go to, like, you know, actually, I think I started hanging out at the Women's Center because the then head, because the Lesbian and Gay Center, I mean, the Lesbian and Gay Student Organization at Penn State had both a social and a political mm-hmm. branch, and, like, they had two heads of each. So there were, like, four leaders, but the then heads, the then female heads of, like, the social and the political were dating each other, and they always and they always hung out at the
Of course,
right. And they always hung out at the Women's Center, so I knew, like, the Women's Center was, like, a place that other lesbians mm-hmm. flocked to, so I started hanging out at the Women's Center.
So did that also lead to your first activism with them, or had you had done LGBT activism before that?
I would say my first activism with them, I did stuff related to LGB activism, mm-hmm. just like being involved in like the campus, the women's center, and like women against rape and things like that. Okay. So like those
right.
frequently involved like lesbian, mm-hmm. lesbian health issues and things like that, but not directly related on, oh, let's create a community for like the lesbian and gays here mm-hmm. at Penn mm-hmm. State. So it wasn't really until I became chair of like the social educational
mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. chair that I probably started doing more activism type of stuff.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So I guess to just finish up that mm-hmm. sort of part, what was it like to be involved with that? Be involved with that activism at that time? Was there any particular, you know, fights that you had at the time in terms of, or was there a particularly memorable event that you did?
I mean, there were always tons of fights going on campus. I mean, and some of them will most likely prove to be ongoing probably still for mm-hmm. like years later. But no, actually, I have to say, I thought Penn State was actually a fairly good place for a lesbian and gay community. It wasn't Madison, mm-hmm. you know, in a way. So definitely there was more things to like fight for and stuff. Mm-hmm. But in some ways, the community was actually more closer knit, and like the allies were also more mm-hmm. closer to the groups and stuff as well. So, you know, in some ways it was fairly easy to be like, okay, this is the issue we're fighting for, like next or something mm-hmm. like type mm-hmm. of thing. Or it's like, well, this is our annual so-and-so rally, and you know, and it's like, and literally it becomes one of those things. It's like, yeah, it's just the annual one, because it's like, there's no way we're getting this like solved anytime soon. You know?
Yeah. Yeah.
So, I mean, it was enjoyable, I thought. I mean, you know, that area of Pennsylvania had like tons of other things going on as well that kind of influenced the community, you know, from, I think you couldn't purchase alcohol after midnight or something like that, mm-hmm. you know, which is actually kind of cool for the State College area, because like the next county over is a dry county where you couldn't purchase like alcohol at all. So they came in, you yeah. know, so there was like a number of dry counties in like Pennsylvania, mm-hmm. You know, so it was like, you know, it's like, okay, midnight's a perfectly fine limit, you know.
You know. It's better than here, it's like 9.
Oh, really, is it?
Yeah.
I didn't realize. It's like, well, I see people drinking all the time.
Well, I think here you can't purchase alcohol in stores after 9, but you can purchase it at bars until like 1 o'clock or something like that.
Okay.
So. Yeah.
What, even liquor stores?
Even liquor stores.
Oh, I didn't know.
They just shut down at 9. Because I'm always like scrambling to get to get there in time.
That's so funny. I didn't even realize, actually. Goes to tell you how much I like buy alcohol. I was like.
Yeah.
But, yeah. I mean, so there were like things like that. But, you know, but there were a couple bars in town where, you know, you had like lesbian gay nights mm-hmm. and stuff like that, mm-hmm. and those were always fun. We did dances, and I can't remember how frequently, kind of like the 10% Society dances, but I don't think as frequently
okay.
as theirs, and I know they're trying to like make theirs less frequent now as well, mm-hmm. now that there's IQ
right.
going on. But yeah, but then we used to do house parties, you know. In fact, like my first or second year out, I kind of lived in what we used to call the dyke house, you know, because it was, you know, it was basically like a house with like, I think 10 of, you know, like 10 of us, like, you know, and me and the political chair actually lived mm-hmm. there, so like both the social and the political chair kind of lived in the house, and then tons of other random women who really, like, you know, of wide variety of interest, you know. It's like, you know, we had some rugby players, and it was really just, you know, it was an interesting mix. Not totally my thing, but it was fine, actually, because I lived on I had the one bedroom on the first floor, and all the other bedrooms were upstairs, so I pretty much could ignore people. So that worked out well for me. But yeah, no, it was a pretty good mix. Changing the, the school's discrimination policy was definitely one of the issues that we worked on. There was some stuff around Joe Paterno. I can't remember what it was, because there was so much stuff around Joe Paterno. Because that was like at kind of like the height of his winning season. Actually, it probably went on for a bit longer after that. But yeah, like I managed to be, I'm a non-sports person, but I managed to be at Penn State during like the 4 or 5 year period where every team at Penn State was in the top 10 of their sports except for men's basketball. And it's like, you know, like sports you would never even heard of. It's like, you know, it's like, what? It's like that, like, not cricket, but
the badminton?
No, it's almost like bat field hockey and stuff like that. It's like, really? What sport is that? You know? Yeah. It's like, oh, but so-and-so is like the number one, you know, field hockey player across the nation. It's like, okay. So literally, I mean, we had Joe Paterno and Renee, whatever her last name was. And she was actually fairly controversial because, like, there were like a slew of lesbians on. Mm-hmm. On the women's basketball team, and the women's basketball team, I think, was number one, maybe number two. Mm-hmm. But, like, she was very controversial because you couldn't come out. And if she suspected you were a lesbian on her team, you wouldn't play, or you would get kicked off the team. So,
not very many players left.
Yeah, and it was kind of interesting. It was just like, yeah. So it was kind of like, you know, people like knew, but like it was just kind of like, oh, okay. It's like, yeah, you know, your basketball team has like half the crowd is like lesbians. And you're like, you know, but yeah. I mean, she got fired or something like that a few years later. Though I think over a totally different issue, but to be perfectly honest, but she was definitely like one of those taskmaster type of person. So outside of that, though, I can't remember. It's not to say that there weren't important things. It was a long time ago.
So when did you first come to Madison? How did you get to the city?
How do I get to Madison? Kind of randomly, to be perfectly honest. Mm-hmm. At that point in time, I was moving around. My goal was to kind of move to live in like at least 5 or 6 different cities in the United States before finding some place. So I was thinking about moving pretty much like every 3 years. It was my last year of college, except that I couldn't take the last like 3 courses that I need for like another year and a half because they were only, they weren't all offered. And I was just like, oh, fuck that. It's like, no way.
Yeah, seriously, it sucks.
So I was talking to one of the therapists at the Women's Center. I don't remember if she's a psychologist or psychiatrist or whatever. But mostly it was just because I'm like, okay, I can't stay here. I'm not staying here. You know, I'll see what I can figure out about the courses. But I'm undecided about moving between, I was thinking at that period of time, the Raleigh dorm area and then Flagstaff were the 2 areas that I was considering. And she recommended Madison. And she's like, I think you'll really like Madison. So I was like, okay, fine. So yeah, then I had a friend who lived in Ann Arbor, and me and another friend, Bob Smith, who we did a lot of organizing work together, and we were pretty good friends. We decided to hitch a ride with her. She dropped us off in Madison, and that was pretty much it. We didn't even have a place to stay.
Wow, how'd that work out? What'd y'all do?
I mean, it was fine. I mean, it was, you know, we got here, like, we came to a 10% Society meeting, I think, like, that night. I mean, it was the summer, so we weren't, like, super worried about it. You know, we were just like, it's the summer. But, yeah, actually, like, we ended up staying in, like, the 10% Society offices. The ones in, like, the junky old buildings that are going to be ripped down sometime soon for a couple weeks, actually, I think, you know. You know, until we found some place to live and whatnot. And that's actually how the campus center got started, to be perfectly honest, because we were there at night and just was reading through all of the historical files that were in the office. And, you know, and I just asked the question, like, why does this campus not have a lesbian and gay center? It was like the big issue, like, I think back from, like, the 70s, from, like, the research that we were going through. And from what I could tell, there was, like, a fairly clear course of action that the dean of students' office was recommending to the students that they could take. But everybody seemed to be very much pushed on getting the Regents to give them a lesbian and gay student center. And, like, the Regents weren't going to, like, budge anytime soon on it. I mean, like, they barely approved, like, the multicultural center, you know? And so, you know, yeah. And it was just kind of one of those things. It was just like, well, I mean, Dean Rouse and, like, Jan Shepherd, I guess, you know, I mean, they pretty much had indicated that, well, you know, you could go through the Board of Regents, which, like, what everybody was doing, and they were fighting it year after year. It's like, or you could just go through student segregated fees. So, pretty much, like, yeah, a month later, I contacted Janice Shepherd with, like, a couple-page plan outlining the process and all of the other stuff, and we got approval, like, maybe 2 or 3 months after that, and we just had to wait for the next kind of, like, fiscal year for everything to kick in. So it was relatively easy to do. It's just that people were, like, so focused in on, like, one course of action that they just, you know, didn't step back to look to see what the other options were.
How did the other people here react to sort of you saying that we should go with this other plan rather than the region plan?
Good question. I have to say, I don't know. you know, I like getting other people's opinions, but I'm not really one of those person who needs to have, like, you know, consensus when I decide to do something. I pretty much decided to do it. I went to this dean or house and all the other stuff, and once I pretty much, you know, thought it was going to happen, then I went to the 10% Society Campus Women's Center and all of those and said, this is what I'm doing. I'd like all you guys to, like, sit on and have a representative spot on the board, and they all agreed, you know? So, I mean, it was, you know, I mean, I suppose, like, if I would have went there first, it's like, well, why don't we do it this way? We could have possibly been debating it for, like, another year or two, you know? But, yeah. I tend not to do those types of debates, so.
You just get in there and do it.
I'm just like, yeah, I mean, like, some things I feel like, okay, you need to have the debates and stuff, but, you know, but for other type of things, it's just kind of like, you're better off just, like, doing it and, like, let the debate be on the particulars. It's like, well, do you really have to, like, does it really have to be off campus? Do you have, like, but, like, you know. Sometimes it's all about how you define the debate. Mm-hmm. You know, because people will debate anything. You don't really want them to be actually debating, well, should we do it this way? It's like, whatever. It's a method of doing it, you know?
So was the campus center still located in the same position as it is now in the Union, or was
the original campus center was actually off campus, on Dayton Street, in the Capitol Center building. There was like the fire station was kind of behind it, and the senior building is kind of like in front of it over there by Cap Foods and stuff like that. It was the space that's kind of like there's a tanning salon in the corner, and then it was like the space next to like that. It was a nice size space. I mean, it was actually kind of about the same size as I think the space in the university. I mean, in the Union right now. But yeah, no, that used to be actually all part of the Multicultural Center. Okay. So like the study area that's across from that, that was like the main offices of the Multicultural Center. Mm-hmm. And the area where the Lesbian and Gay Center was is where like the multicultural student organizations used to meet. And then they used to also have that room where the tickets are being sold, and that used to be a computer center for the multicultural students.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So yeah, no, in fact, I was speaking, I think, to Eric or no, one of the guys from the 10% Society, and I was like expressing my surprise that they didn't actually have the computer room as well. Mm-hmm. But yeah, but they took that, and I guess like they were like, yeah, we're taking that back for ticketing or something, you know. but yeah, so no, it was actually nice to be off campus. I mean, it wasn't like a goal to like keep it off campus, but I mean, but it was kind of easier to get rent money at that period of time than it was to get space on campus.
Right.
Space on campus was pretty much at a premium, and any space that they were offering would have, like, actually at that period of time been, like, a room or something like that.
Oh, okay.
And we really wanted a space where we could do support group meetings, you know, or like smaller type of events, and then of course like the larger events were done on campus, and we had the lending library there and you know and whatnot, so and it was close enough to campus for people to not be bothered for the walk, you know.
So what was the process of getting it set up off campus? What was that sort of story?
It actually really wasn't that much of a process, to be perfectly honest. I mean, it was mostly just finding a space, and I can't remember how I found the space. I think I just actually walked that area, you know, looking for possible rental spaces. I mean, obviously, we needed the rent to be not super expensive, because the rent was going to end up being kind of like the biggest part of the funding allocation to us, and so we needed the rent to not be super expensive. We needed it to be a nice size space. I mean, obviously it wasn't super large, but it was like enough space where we kind of had library books kind of like over in this corner, and then like a couch and a chair kind of in front of those, so like people could like pick a book, sit down in the library, and then there was like another couch kind of like back over there, I think with a TV actually as well, but that's kind of where like some of the smaller support groups meant. And then we kind of had like a desk at the front, like near the front, and then we kept most of the other space open so that if we were doing like receptions and things like that, that there was like enough room for people to like mix and mingle and and walk around. So, I mean, it was a fairly simple setup, but I mean, it was fairly effective, I think, for the size space that it was, you know. I just started walking the area, found that space. I guess it had been at that period of time like empty for a couple years or something like that. Once we had the full approval from SUFAC, I'm trying to remember if I signed the rental contracts or if we got the Dean of Students Office to sign the rental contracts. I can't remember who signed the rental contracts, but yeah, you know, we just got the contract signed for it. We did a lot of like pre-work between, because we got the approval pretty quickly. I mean, because it was one of those things, it was like, it's like, oh, you could do this in a month and get know before this end of this semester that you have approval for like the next year, or you have to wait until like the next year do it. Mm-hmm. So it kind of like just did this like big push to get everything up and approved. And I mean, it went through really quickly. I mean, I think they came back at me, and I'm trying to remember who was working with me at that period of time. I mean, like they just came back with like maybe I think two or three questions that we needed. They wanted further clarification. And after we did the clarification for that, they approved pretty much the entire budget. I think they did drop the budget some, but that was fine. I mean, it was still, it was still like a livable budget. I mean, because it was just kind of like the rental space, a little bit money for programming, and then like a quarter of a salary. Quarter of a position salary for me and half a position salary for a student, because I wasn't obviously a student at the university at that period of time, which was fine because I was already doing multicultural work with the United Council, actually.
Mm-hmm. So you sort of had a couple different projects going on at the same time?
Kind of, yeah. I mean, like, once, like, I got here, you know, it was pretty much, okay, you know, find a place to live, you know, see what's happening and, you know, find a job. And so, like, I think the first job I got was actually at the union doing, like, food preparation, you know. But it was just, like, a summer limited term type of thing, and it was, like, immediate money, you know. Right. From, like, there, then I applied for a position with the United Council of Student Governments, because I figured that would be a good way to like find out what's really going on in the university system. I was doing like the Lesbian and Gay Center, and as I said, you know, the approval for it happened 6-8 months before we could actually do anything. Mm-hmm. I'm trying to remember like what your school cycles are, but like, you know, it was like, it's not like really a year, but it's like a student year or whatever.
Right.
I mean, I'm possibly making it sound easier than it was, but it wasn't really that complicated, to be perfectly honest. Uh-huh. It was just one of those things that it was just kind of like, it like really, I mean, it literally, it was up and running like a little bit later, but all the approval for funding and all of that other stuff was pretty much done in just a couple months. Like the Dean of Students Office was like gung-ho behind it. You know, they put Janice Shepherd as our advisor to it, and they put in like letters of recommendation recommending that it would be funded and all of that other stuff. And then there was the 10% Society, there was GLEMA, which was like the Gay and Lesbian Student of Color group. There was Campus Women's Center. I think we got some people from the Multicultural Center, and I forget who else rounded up out the board. I think we also got a representative from, I think they're called Outreach now, but I'm trying to remember what their name was back then.
Right,
they were like
a
different name like back then. Like, so we got some representatives from like the community as well to like, you know, to sit on the board of directors. And I mean, our big issue, or like at least my big focus was at that period of time to like really make sure that it was inclusive of like lesbian and gay and bisexual people of color, and then women and people with disabilities. So we actually had like a much larger, I think, slant on disenfranchised communities at that period of time. But otherwise, I think, you know, they're following some of the, I don't know if that's just happenstance or if they're like just continuing along to doing it, but there's, I think they're still continuing in some ways, like some of the programs we initiated, because I know like second year in existence, I was just kind of like, okay, we need to get integrated into the classroom structure. So once like we had the lending library set up, like I just started doing like letters and face-to-face visits to all these humanity instructors. Right. It's like, well, you know, if this topic might be of interest to like your students when they're writing reports, and we have, the books that they can use, and all of a sudden, like there's students like trekking in. It's like, I'm doing a research report on, you know, and then we actually had like this speakers bureau, which I don't know if they still have going into like the classrooms and the dormitories and things like that. In fact, I think now their library system is connected to the university library system. But at that period of time, it totally wasn't. me and the associate director, I hired this guy called Joe Ubaker, I believe, or something like that, Ubaker, whatever. But we were also both geeks, and so we actually designed a database system for like the lending library system. So it's like, so we had like the first kind of lending library of any of the student groups on campus, and like then we ended up like passing out the database system to like I think like 10 other student organizations on campus. It's like actually the other student organizations really loved us because we would do their graphic design work for them.
Yeah, I bet.
Like, we'll do your graphic design work for this event and this event, and you'll co-sponsor this event.
Yeah.
For us, like, we, like, really had hardly any money for programming, but, like, we got all the other student organizations to, like, pay for our, like, events, and we just did work for them.
Hey, that sounds fantastic. You know? What a great deal. Yeah. Like.
So, yeah.
So, during that 8 months in between, before we get back to some of the, like, programming and stuff, during that 8 months in between when y'all were given approval and then actually opened up, sort of like what happened with the center during that?
Mostly it was like hiring. So as I put out the position announcement for an assistant director. And then we just had like a part-time helper. I can't remember what that position was called. Then finding the space, finding furniture and stuff. Like, actually, we got a fair amount of stuff through, like, UW Surplus.
Right.
Not St. Vincent de Paul, but... No, actually, you guys do have a St. Vinny's, so quite possibly St. Vinny's as well. I was like, is that a San Francisco? So, let's see, what else? And then a fair amount of outreach, actually, but not, well, I mean, I guess it would depend on what you consider, like, the real outreach. It was, like, at that period of time, it was, like, the manual kind of outreach, going to various meetings, talking to people, telling people what to expect, you know, inviting people to various events and things like that. So, definitely, that type of outreach, but it wasn't until, like, before the center officially opened, but when we actually had the space set up and everything, that we started doing what I kind of consider the outreach, which is like electronic. I mean, it was early at that stage, but we had actually like a massive like email list. We hooked the center up with the National Gay and Lesbian Task Force because I used to do work for them as well, because like we had started, like they used to have a People of Color Institute. And, you know, and I used to help organize for them. So spreading out word throughout the UW system, because there wasn't any other lesbian and gay center in any of the UW system. So, like, we kind of, like, started sending out the words. Like, you can call for, like, support, like, telephone support. You can, if you want to put on an event, you know, we can see if we can get people to travel up there, you know. It's like, can't borrow our books, but you can. It's like, sorry, our lending library is not. but, you know, yeah, so, like, I guess there were two phrases. There was, like, the face-to-face stuff, and then, like, we had a few weeks before students got back on campus where we were kind of in office but not officially open, and then that was kind of like more of the electronic, you know, stuff, like collecting email addresses, putting together really massive kind of like resource lists across the board, and, you know, about that, and designing flyers, and putting together, like, well, what's going to be our list of events for the year, and, like, who can we possibly get to, like, help, you know, with them and stuff like that. So, yeah, and then we had our grand opening, like, I think the first or second week of school.
So, what sort of program, so then what sort of programming did y'all sort of start to do at first, those, like, first... that, like, first year, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, we did a lot of stuff. In fact, actually, let's see, I'm trying to think. I mean, obviously, you know, we did, we initiated a number of support groups. Like, we had Bi Shy Y. I think there was a transgender group. There, you know, then there was, like, a coming out group. I definitely did not do that, because I'm like, I actually am fairly supportive of people coming out, but at the same time, it's like, yeah, after, like, Penn State, I was just like, I will never do another coming out. I'm like, I do not have the proper mentality for her. But there were, like, a couple of really good people who led, like, the coming out group, and we set up the space as, like, a meeting space. We really wanted to get people to, like, start using the space immediately. So it was a meeting space for some groups that had already existed and were trying to, like, find regular meeting space around town. But then also, like, you know, we would occasionally, you know, do things like offer to do, you know, well, we'll do your reception for this event, you know, and you can have our space for, like, the evening, like, you know, for free and stuff. I know we did that for a couple of the Women's Center's event, because they just had, like, that, well, it was actually bigger than a 10% society, but it was, like, a smaller space, like, over there, like, that was kind of shared between 10% society, the Women's Center, Wonk Shink, and... there was some other organization there that I can't remember, you know, so, you know, so, like, we would do some of the receptions for some of the other organization events there. And then we started up a People of Color speaker series, you know, which actually went over very well. I say that as if I'm surprised, but I was kind of surprised, you know, because it's, like, typically speaking, you know, the 10% Society was bringing in, like, really, like, all these really big known name people, which, you know, invariably always ended up being, like, white, you know, white, very attractive looking guys, you know.
How'd that happen, you know? Right.
Exactly. You know, so we did this People of Color speaker series, and I think the first year we did it, we did just four. Four speakers, most likely that nobody who wasn't a person, I mean, even most people of color hadn't heard of them. So, like, there's only, like, queer people of color who might have actually happened to hear about these, you know, these people, mostly women, actually. And the first year was, actually, the first year we got better turnout than we expected, but was still, actually, the second year, like, the turnouts were getting, like, incredibly large. for the event. So, like, the first year, you know, like, the turnouts were maybe, like, around 50 people or something like that. You know, and we got the Multicultural Center involved, and we, like, you know, ramrod it like some of the other student groups, you know. It's like, really, do you not want your name on this?
Yeah.
<You know?
laughs> Yeah.
It's like, it's a black woman coming to campus. Like,
you gotta have your name on the flyer.
Right, exactly. You know, So that type of stuff, like, and that actually, that series took off, like, pretty well, and we started doing that, I think, every year, and, like, in fact, I think we grew it to 6 times a year, like, so every other month there was a speaker, and we even got some of the secondary colleges in town involved with it, like, Edgewood College actually co-sponsored a couple of them, because then we just did kind of, like, a dual, you know, so they would speak on Madison, and then, like, maybe do a class presentation or something like that on Edgewood, you know, at Edgewood, and, you know, and so, yeah, so we did that, and I'm trying to think, there were a couple conferences, but I don't think they were here in Madison. We got, actually, Madison, the Lesbian and Gay Center, and then, like, pulled in a little bit, whatever outreach was called. Like, bam, that, like, name is forever gone. But because I was already doing some work with the National Gay and Lesbian Task Force, we worked with them to kind of create, like, a Midwest regional lesbian and gay student conference, and got a fair number of people to participate in that and go to that. Yeah, but then, like, the other stuff was, like, a little bit more focused in on integration in, like, the classrooms and the dormitories, really acting as, like, a resource and a kind of a reference for people. And not just on, as I said before, like, not just on lesbian and gay issues as well. We wanted to actually be of service to some of the organizations that we felt like that we were closely aligned to, or that we should be closely aligned to, even if they didn't necessarily have that much of interest to it. But, you know, it was more just a matter of coming up ways to make them, like, feel like, okay, you know, even if we don't like them that much, they design great flyers, and they seem to, like, really be able to, like, to send out, like, you know, information to, like, a large number of people very rapidly. It's because, like, you know, at that period of time, like, you know, it was still, you know, UW, Penn State, like, tons of, most of the schools were, like, handing out your email on, like, a floppy disk, you know? It's like, yeah, it's hard to imagine now, but it was just kind of like, you know, it was still, like, you know, the early stages, you know, and it's like, so, like, the universities were at the forefront of giving all of their students, like, email, but, like, typically you got, like, you know, a floppy disk with, like, Eudora on it, and you could, like, take it to any computer on campus and, like, and put it in. But most student organizations and stuff hadn't actually really learned how. I mean, like, they could barely check their own email. They didn't actually know how to do, like, listservs or, like, any of that type of stuff. So we were, like, gangbangers to them. Like, it was just like, it's like, why don't you just give that to us and we can send it out to, like, 800 people, you know? Right. Okay. So, the benefits of having geeks on, you know?
Yeah, we're, like, at the forefront of that. So how do you think that sort of things changed either for the campus or for the Madison once the center came?
Once the center came? It's hard to say, to be perfectly honest. I mean, I think the center did act as a great resource and stuff, but I'm not certain if I would consider it life-changing.
Right. Sure.
But that's just me. I mean, other people quite possibly did, but I wasn't... and totally enmeshed in like the Madison culture.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, I mean, I had only been here for a couple months when I started the center, so it's like I wasn't really that immersed in everything mm-hmm. that was going on. I had kind of like just a background knowledge from like the State Historical Society mm-hmm. and the 10% Society files about what had been happening, what was currently happening, the various issues and stuff that people were fighting for. And then obviously, like, you know, I started going to some of the 10% Society meetings, but I rapidly kind of like limit that to like mm-hmm. you know, just like one meeting per month or something like that. I mean, you know, nothing like against them, it was just like not, I mean, a lot of the meetings were really kind of just like these, they were either going after this issue or this issue kind of continuously, or they were planning like a dance, you know.
Right.
Mm-hmm. You know, and it just kind of wasn't really where
mm-hmm.
I was, you know, at. I was more into services, obviously, like from mm-hmm. my nonprofit mm-hmm. background. I'm like a service type of girl. So like the political rallies and things like that, I'm like, okay, I participate in here mm-hmm. and there, but like, you know, debating like what should happen, when should happen, like why are we demanding this? Like it's like,
right.
whatever, you know.
Right.
But, you know, but that was fine because, like, there were other members of the board that would go
mm-hmm.
to those meetings and, like, you know, or, you know, like, there was actually a representative from those organizations also on
mm-hmm.
on the board. So I felt like, you know, we were getting the information. I mean, or at least I felt like I was getting the information that we needed
mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. to, like, act as a, you know, as a resource for other people who might be interested in those type of things. But,
mm-hmm.
Yeah, but, like, we didn't really, I mean, like, some people were like, well, aren't you going to distract from, like, the 10% Society? And my original thought was, like, no, and to be perfectly honest, I don't, at least not at that period of time, I don't believe that we did. I mean,
mm-hmm.
you know, they had, like, their big money maker was, like, the 10% Society dance, and they used to make a ton of money off of those. I mean, obviously now they're thinking about limiting them because, like, IQ is like actually taking away most of their
right
mm-hmm. their traffic for that. But before that, they were, that the 10% Society dances were pretty much the only game in town. I mean,
mm-hmm.
there was like the Hotel Washington for a while, but that was mostly there on weekends, and then for people who were above the age of 21, you know.
Right.
And so you know, so not that it wasn't great, you know, before it burned down. But, I mean, it was actually a really nice building. I mean, because it was like, I guess, did they actually have a hotel? I think there was a hotel on top of it. But it was basically a series of like four or five bars in it, like the Barber's Closet, which was like my favorite
uh-huh.
bar. There was like a dance club there. And then, like, another type of, like, darker bar. I don't want to call it a leather bar. Actually, it was a leather bar. Never mind. So never mind. Let's just call that a leather bar. There was, like, a leather bar, and then there was, like, this food restaurant, like, you know, type of place. And, you know, there. And so, yeah, I mean, so, like, a lot of, I mean, that was actually, outside of the 10% Society, that was kind of like the other
mm-hmm.
Place to go, but mostly on weekends for
mm-hmm.
that. So it was pretty much like, oh, okay, so people still flock to the 10% Society dance. I mean, so I thought what we brought to the table were really more services and the consolidation of services, because there were tons of random support groups
mm-hmm.
around, you know, and tons of people kind of doing stuff like individually, but like not really having access to like regular meeting spaces or things like that. So we kind of like offered, I thought, that ability is like, you can use our space to meet. You can come
mm-hmm.
here for regular, you can, you know, we had like a nice schedule of like the groups that were meeting there on a regular basis, and then we left some slots open so that people can fit things
mm-hmm.
in on the random basis. And then you know, even during the days, like some people would come in to like organize their mm-hmm. their stuff, because it's like, okay, we weren't a coffee shop, but we, you know, there was a TV, there was a radio, there were books, you know, like you could sit around and like talk, mm-hmm. you know, and work, and we had internet access. So.
Yeah.
The only thing we were missing was like the coffee, but yeah, like neither Joe or myself drank coffee, so like it was. So it was like, just like, whatever, you know, Steep and Brews like, around the corner.
Yeah.
So,
mm-hmm.
So yeah, I mean, and I think also we did provide at that period of time anyway, like kind of a central point for the rest of the UW system mm-hmm. as well, unlike lesbian and gay issues. We actually did act as like a resource for like lesbian and gay organizations at other campuses. Like if they wanted to start one up, we would mm-hmm. do the research for them. Like
right. What
other resources are in the area? Who do you think you need to speak to? And things like that. I mean, mm-hmm. that was stuff that was all feasible to do. I mean, not in the same way that it is now, because like now it's like you can find almost anything online.
right.
But
yeah.
like, there was still a fair amount of information online at that period of time, even though it wasn't like the multitude at that period of time. And for like a lot of these people, it was just like, you know, they hadn't really organized anything, mm-hmm. you know, like maybe event or something like that. But when it came to, you know, it's like, well, how do we get a center or how do we get a space or something like that? You know, so there were tons of questions about that or mm-hmm. like who they should mm-hmm. outreach to. Like, you know, I mean, in Wisconsin at that period of time, and I don't know if it was just Wisconsin or if it was just Madison or if it was Madison that set the example for the rest of the UW systems, but the first reaction was to go into kind of protest mode as opposed to like going into planning mode, mm-hmm. you know. I mean, and it's not to say that you don't have to protest sometimes, but it's like, you know, if you kind of want a space on campus, blah, 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 this, you know, your first step shouldn't be like, oh, let's go protest the Board of Regents, you know? Mm-hmm. I mean, it might come down to that, but, you know, you should, like, actually kind of figure out, well, where could the space actually be on campus? Is that space being used? Can it, you know, mm-hmm. it's like, you know, if you're going to be adding it on to a space that already exists, do you have the agreement of the people
right.
who already have the space, you know? Mm-hmm. It's like, mm-hmm. you know, you don't just kind of, like, go protest gangbusters and like not actually have any answers to
right.
to these like any of these questions, you know, type of deal. So mm-hmm. We kind of help people with like getting those answers, and then it was like, then if you want to protest, go right ahead. You know, because like then at least you have like the answers. Like, you know, if somebody's like, well, where's it gonna go? You're not gonna be like, well, you guys have to find the space.
Yeah. Make a protest about that too.
Right, exactly. You know.
Yeah. So, sort of two sets of questions, but I guess so. Still on the center for the first one. Were there any in those sort of years, any big conflicts or anything like that? Any tensions that the center had with other groups or that were within the center or anything like that?
Not while I was there, to be perfectly honest. But mm-hmm. I believe the year after I left, there was like a fairly big conflict. And to be perfectly honest, it was probably brewing beforehand. But I'm not a big agitator.
Right.
So, and I'm also like fairly good at getting kind of around other people's agitation and kind of like focusing them in on what I consider the point of action as opposed to,
right.
you know, what they're kind of like arguing, you know,
right. mm-hmm.
about. So definitely, I mean, I think before I left, I already knew that there was going to be a couple points of contention. I mean, one of the biggest points was going to be like how much work we did on lesbian and gay people of color and mm-hmm. kind of disenfranchised communities. But the second one was always going to be SUFEC funding, because there were definitely people who thought the campus center shouldn't get SUFAC funding. Mm-hmm. You know, it was just like, well, it doesn't serve the entire student population. It's like, actually, we did. And yeah. I went out of our way to make sure that we had the numbers and statistics to prove that we weren't just serving, like, the lesbian and gay community, even though that was kind of, like, our ultimate, you know,
right,
you know, goal, you know, at that period of time. But, yeah, unfortunately, I know, and I don't really even know the full story around this, because I left right before our next SUFEC funding meeting. I mean, it wasn't like, yeah, it was like maybe a month or so before, but it was the beginning of the school year. So like, and I was planning on going, we hired somebody, and like we knew that like they were gonna take over at the beginning of the school year, and I was going to be gone, and you know, and I was just kind of like, I thought it would be fine, but like when we were choosing a candidate, it came down to like two issues really for us. There was the one guy who we really thought could navigate, you know, the student government and SUFAC and all of that other stuff very well, but he really, really, really sucked on like service issues, people of color, like all those type of type of stuff. But he was really good at like dealing with like the student government and all of that stuff. In fact, he had actually served on the student government. And then the other guy was pretty much, you know, a newbie in all things like student government, but was actually fairly good on like the service issues and things like that. And so that came down to our decision around that. And, you know, and I kind of made the final decision to go with the person with the service thing. And I was just kind of like, I'm in San Francisco, but give me a call. You know, it's like, we can go over all this other stuff like that. And it's like, I can walk you through this, but whatever, you know, everybody wants to be independent when, you know, so like they didn't call, you know, they didn't ask for my assistance, and like they got their budget slashed, I think, in half. You know, almost like immediately, you know, and it was, you know, I think it was kind of very upsetting for not only him, but, you know, for the board of directors and stuff there, you know, And, you know, I felt bad about it, but then at the same time, it was just like, I told you to call.
Right.
I'm like, you know, it was like, I'm like, I told you what you were going to be coming up against. And it's like, it's not like we hadn't dealt with these, you know, this stuff each year. It wasn't like people were like, oh, yeah, let's give them money.
Whether they ever, like, let's just give them money.
You know, I mean, it's like, exactly. It's like, you know, it's like, you know, and he was just like, well, I felt like I was, like, unprepared, and you hadn't warned me, and I'm just like, you know, it was, you know, but, yeah, but that was actually, I think, a really big disappointment, because I think because of the funding cuts, they did actually, the year after that is when they ended up moving back on campus, and it, their first move back on campus was, like, incredibly small space. I don't know where it was at, but I remember somebody describing it, describing it to me, and it was just kind of like, you know, they got the promise that once the red gym was completed that they would get a larger space, but it was, like, really, yeah, like, a kind of a massive step down in terms of, like, services and research resources and things like that, and I think that lasted for, like, maybe 2 or 3 years. From that. So what Eric has today is really almost like a total rebuilding like, you know, of the center, you know, because I mean, and I think they offer, like, as I said before, a lot of the same services or like in different components and stuff of what we did before, but that's like, you know, from where they started out from on campus, that was almost like just rebuilding a totally new organization as opposed to what was there priorly. So a lot of effort, I think, on their part to kind of get it back up, you know.
Absolutely. I know you said you're bad with years, but do you remember what year it was that you left and went to San Francisco?
Let's
Even
see.
If just a range?
I'm trying to think. I want to say something like 96, 97.
Okay.
Well, actually, let me back up. Let's see. started Nonprofit Tech in 98. I was in San Francisco for, I think, a year, year and a half before I did that. So, yeah, maybe, like, yeah, not around 96, I think.
All right, great, yeah.
Yeah.
Just wanted to sort of have a sort of reference point on the tape. So
yeah, I mean, so something like that. I mean, I was, I think I, you know, I was at the center for, I think, 4 years.
Mm-hmm.
Before,
mm-hmm.
before I left, you know. And we did, and I did give, I think, like, almost a year. Well, it wasn't a full calendar year. I think it was, like, an academic year.
Right.
Like, notice that, you know. Mm-hmm. I'm thinking about leaving.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, I was only planning on staying here for, like, you know, 3 to 5 years, and it's already been past three.
Right, yeah.
So yeah, it seems probably close enough.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, that's great, yeah. So I guess my last set of questions is about what it was just like living in Madison during that time, that during that time of when you were setting up the center and whatnot. You mentioned that you like to go to the barber's closet.
The barber's closet is part of Hotel Washington.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. What was it like in Madison? I had a ball, to be perfectly honest.
Yeah.
I mean, I really liked Madison. I mean, it's amazing that it was, like, never on my list of places to live. You know, I moved out to the east side. I had a fairly nice apartment. Rent was low. And, yeah, I mean, I divided a fair amount of my time between the Lesbian and Gay Campus Center and then other organizing work. Like, I worked with the United Council, I think, for, like, 2 years. I worked at Edgewood College for a couple years. And then I had, like, kind of sideline national projects that I was doing as well. But, yeah, you know, I mean, there was a small but, like, pretty strong, like, lesbian, gay, people of color community here. Yeah, like, the Hotel Washington, like, in the three or four bars and stuff there were good avenues. And then, you know, there were a couple other things. Like, there was, like, Club 3052 that was out East Washington.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Amy's Cafe was always pretty gay-friendly. And then there was, like, some place on the square that I think is still there that used to do, like, some type of gay night, like, once a month or something.
Oh, okay.
You know, but for me, yeah, for me it was kind of, like, a perfect environment. I don't like my towns too big. I don't drive. So I'm a walker. I love walking past water. And San Francisco, like, is a bay, and it's just, like, never saw the water. Hated it.
Right.
It was like you had to take special trips to go out to the water. So yeah, I mean, I felt like, you know, there was a fair amount of activity. I mean, like, people complained definitely about, you know, oh, there wasn't this resource or that resource or things like that. But I mean, we had a number of really good bookstores. Yeah. Listen to me. There were good bookstores. there were good bookstores. There was, like, a bar, a food place. I'm good.
I got what I need.
Exactly. It's like my internet connection. Hey, I'm ready.
A geek after my own heart.
But, yeah, I mean, like, there was a room of one's own, which is, like, I mean, it seems like it's been here forever. I mean, I don't know when it started up, but, you know, it was here when I got there. Like, they actually started expanding, like, their lesbian and gay collection quite a lot, actually, once we moved around, because we were coming in, like, ordering special books, like, all the time from them. It's like, you're right around the corner. You can order these books for us. I mean, that was before Amazon.
Right, yeah.
So, You know, there was a room of one, there was Canterbury Books, which I think now is just the inn, but it used to be both the inn and the bookstore.
Mm-hmm.
They actually used to do quite a lot of stuff on lesbian gay. issues as well. In fact, actually, a number of the bookstores here like had started doing lots of things around like lesbian and gay issues. Like, mm-hmm. I mean, they would do full displays for out and about month or week or stuff like uh-huh, that. Uh-huh. You know, I mean, it used to be we would like, you know, go to a room of one's own. It's like, this is coming up. Can you do a display? And then like after a while, it was just like, oh, so-and-so, and so they would just send us notice yeah. that they're doing, like, a display. We're like, great. Yeah. You know? Uh-huh. So yeah, I mean, I thought it was a pretty nice environment to live in. But, you know, some people, I think, want very different things than what I want out an environment. And obviously, you know, it's like, it's not Milwaukee. You know, there's not a club. A scene. Well, actually, I guess now there is kind of a club scene, but at that period of time, there wasn't really a club scene, you know, mm-hmm. going on. I mean, there wasn't like the massive amount of people and access to people, you know, but, you know, on the other end, it's like we didn't have the Dahmer here. I mean, I was here during the Jeffrey Dahmer years, and it's like, you know, it's like, it's like that wasn't going on in Madison either, you know, so... So yeah, I mean, it was kind of like, you know, I would do like typically the campus center in like in the day, like a secondary job in like an afternoon. I would come back like for some evening programs to the campus center, meet up with like whoever was like at that meeting. And it's like, oh, let's go to the barber's closet. And, you know, we'd sit and talk politics that always turned into sex. And we drink some more. And like we walk home, you know.
Yeah.
So it's like I thought it was good.
Every good queer conversation turns to sex.
Exactly. As far as I'm concerned, every good conversation turns to sex. It's like you don't know if the conversation's really good unless it eventually leads you down.
Yeah, exactly. Right. Especially with a couple drinks at the club.
Right. Yeah. So, I mean, I thought it was a very nice. I mean, and I still do, obviously. I mean, I came back to Madison. I mean, and obviously it's in some ways very different. Like, I haven't gotten super involved in, like, the lesbian and gay community since I've been back for a couple of reasons. I mean, one, I haven't, like, felt, like, the strong need. But two, like, I spent, like, the first 4 years, I think, when I was back taking care of my mom, who was, like, really sick. And then she just passed away recently. So, you know, so then... much more familiar with the senior community, you know, and senior resources and like, you know, and things like that. But, I mean, I think in some ways it seemed like it was easier to connect to like the lesbian and gay community then, than it does now. But that's also because I'm not actually, I mean, like, There is IQ and like there's like the various lesbian and gay sports associations and things like that. So I don't feel like I have one friend who feels like there's nothing going on. I'm not one of those people. I feel like there's a lot of stuff going on. I just feel like it's not really that much going on that I'm interested right now. But like I wouldn't like just because I'm not interested. I don't feel like there's nothing going on. It's just it's like my interest is like. Have narrowed down, you know, I feel like my interests have, like, narrowed down, like, a lot since then, you know. And I do feel like, I mean, obviously there's the club, the IQ, and they also do, like, another club somewhere else. The disco, Discotheque is part of IQ as well.
Yeah, they have Discotheque, and then they have, like, a girl night.
Right.
And then they have some other... They have, like, a Night at the Cardinal or something like
right,
that.
Right, yeah. I mean, I feel like those things are of interest and things like that. But, you know, I'm not really a big bar. I don't mind bars. I'm not a big club person. Even when I was in San Francisco, I'm just like, you mean the date rotates? I'm just like, you know, yeah. I'm like, I like my clubs, like, I like my bars, just be there. And I'm like, if I'm randomly thinking, oh, I'm in the neighborhood, let's stop by, you know.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know?
So, you know, my friends call me a fuddy-duddy in San Francisco. I'm like, I'm sorry, I can't remember, like, the first Thursday of, like, random, like, every third month or something. I'm just like, what the... like, there really shouldn't have to be mathematics involved in, like, the, in the process, you know, for, you know, so definitely, like, I think having, like, some place like the Hotel Washington there where it was always just like, oh, let's go to the barber's closet or let's go to, I forget what the dance part of it was called, you know, let's go out dancing, you know, and stuff like that. I mean, and obviously, as I said, there were, like, the other, there were, like, the two other places, like, the one out towards Fitchburg, I think, is still there, but Club 3054 is kind of gone now. You know, and there's still, like, the one out towards Fitchburg, but I don't drive. It's a long way.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah. So, I mean, so definitely I feel like that resource is kind of missing, and that's been kind of substitute with, like, a club resources, which I consider perfectly viable, but just not as interesting to me.
Right.
You know, because, like, when it comes down to it, it's just kind of like, oh, yeah, you know, I can stay out to 2 or 3, but you actually need to have me out by 6 p.m. It's like, if I'm not out of my house by 6 p.m., it's just like, oh, yeah, no.
They just gotta get you to go to dinner first, and then...
Exactly, dinner, then, like, a bar to drink, yeah. And then we can go to the club. But, like, yeah. It's like 11 o'clock, 11 p.m., meeting up to go to a club. It's like,
yeah.
It's like not happening. So yeah, I mean, like, I feel like the scene, I feel like things are, like, different, but at the same time I still feel like there's, Madison has, like, you know, a lot of great resources, I think, for the lesbian and gay community, and I don't necessarily feel people value how much at ease it can be here versus, like, elsewhere in the country. I mean, I feel like, you know, and it's a good thing, I think, like, but I feel like people are fighting for stuff all the time that they don't actually sit down and be like, Madison's a great place for lesbian and gay people to be. I mean, like, who would think somewhere in, like, the Midwest would have, like, such a strong resource area and such a large population of lesbian and gay you know, people here as well. I mean, I think it's, like, estimated at, like, what, 25% or something like that of the population? Or at least that's what it used to be estimated at, you know, I mean, of people who identified as, like, lesbian, gay, or bi, you know, or, like, just kind of queer identified. I mean, and that's actually, I think, one of, like, the benefits here in Madison. There are tons of people who would just queer identify, even if they've never had a same-sex partner whatsoever. They're like, I'm cool with it. I'm down with it, you know. It's like, I thought about it, but, like, you know. You know, so, I mean, that really just doesn't happen in, like, a lot of other other places, you know. And I think people kind of, like, forget that, you know. Or sometimes they get too comfortable with that, you know, because, like, sometimes they, like, assume that everything that happens in Madison, like, that's the way everybody in Wisconsin, like, feels about it. And it's like, yeah, no, Madison's kind of like a nice gay mecca on the water in, like, central Wisconsin. You
know? Definitely.
You know? So... Yeah, I mean, I still feel like it's, like, you know, it's a great place to be, you know, as, like, a lesbian and gay person, especially if you're not into, like, the big cities, you know. You know, but then, you know, if you're into the big cities, obviously, you know, there's Chicago, there's Milwaukee, or you can do the brain drain to either of the crows, you know.
Yeah,
or, like, what we call the, I always call it the brain drain, because it's, like, everybody, like, splits to either the East or the West Coast, and that's where, like, 90% of the funding for, like, various services, like, and stuff, like, goes as well, you know. And so, you know, it's always very interesting. I mean, I think the Midwest always does have its very particular, own particular sets of issues, especially around funding of various types of services and stuff. And always doing more, I think, with, like, a lot less funding. Oh, hell. I mean, like, when I first moved to San Francisco, I mean, I became part of, like, this great program there. It was called Health Initiatives for Youth, And we did basically youth HIV work. And in fact, Pedro Zamora from like the Real World, whatever season that was, he actually did work with the organization, him and his lover, Sean Sasser, and things like that. I mean, so it was a great organization. And I actually worked on like a startup project up under it that was called Provider Services or Youth Providers or something like that. Mm-hmm. But the goal was to provide resources, information, and training to all of the organizations in the 6-county Bay Area that could possibly have to deal with gay and lesbian youth. So it was perfect for me because I was just in San Francisco and I needed to get a lay of the land. And it was like, perfect. A nice database of all the youth service organizations, there. But at the same time, you know, we got a lot of money to do the services that we did, and we did them incredibly well. So I'm not like complaining about that. But typically speaking, about 10 to 20 times the amount of money than you could get here in like Madison to do a similar type of services, but only had to serve like maybe like far less. It's like with the Lesbian and Gay Center when I was running it, we were serving over 30,000 people a year.
Wow.
In terms of programming and things like that. You know, and part of that was just like, I think how Joe and I kind of like, approach like outreach and programming and services and stuff like that. And we complimented each other, I think, very well. And he was way more outgoing than I am. So he got to like, he's like, go out there and flirt with everybody. And like, you know, you know, and, but I mean, we were serving, yeah, like I think our first year, like we served something like 20,000-25,000. And the next year we did like a leapfrog increase. of that. And like, I think our annual budget was like less than, I want to say like less than $50,000 a year or something like that. And you know, our budget with like, you know, Health Initiative for Youth was like around $375,000. We only had to serve like 3,000 people a year.
Wow.
Yeah. I mean, so that's like, really the difference between those types of, I mean, like when people like joke about like the brain drain and stuff, they don't actually really, I think, consider what it really means. It's not that people are just leaving the Midwest to go there, but that's where all the funding is going there as well. And they have to serve way less people for it. I mean, and but what it does is like, you think, well, that would give us advantage, we're going to outreach to more people. It doesn't though, because what happens is like all these government institutions and like foundations and stuff base their target numbers off of these other organizations from the East and West Coast. So from their perspective, if you come in and say you're going to serve 50,000 people on $100,000, they're like, you don't know what you're talking about. You can you can't do it. Your grant is out the window before it's even considered. You don't even make the first tier of cutoffs, and there's typically three tiers of cutoffs. I mean, there's just typically the first tier is like all these random people just going through saying, no, the budget numbers don't even match up with what we're looking for, you know? And that's how like most of like the funding gets cut out of the Midwest, because, you know, like the Midwest is giving, I think, you know, what we really consider realistic numbers. It's like, well, you know, you can serve that many because you're already serving this many at this point. But then, you know, but then you're like getting compared to like someplace in San Francisco or something like that, where they're like, you know, we need $500,000 to serve 5,000 people. You know, and you know, and so it really, you know, I mean, it kind of creates this massive world of like disparities in like funding, but not just for like the lesbian and gay community, but across the board in terms of services. I mean, and I think people really just don't understand like that. I mean, they really like, they're just like, well, I thought it was a good proposal, and like they keep on going back to like refining their proposal, or like they're like, I must have asked for too much. And like, they keep on like shortfalling. It's like, yeah, no, actually half of your proposals are rejected because you didn't ask for enough money. I mean, like, literally, it was like, you know, like, they'll have, like, these criterias, like, we're looking to fund, like, a $250,000 to a $500,000 proposal, and you put in a proposal for $50,000.
Right.
You know?
Right, yeah.
You know, it's amazing, you know?
Yeah, I didn't quite ever realize it was that stark, you know? Yeah, wow.
So, anyway. That's my soapbox.
So was there anything else that you wanted to add or that you wanted to add to your story?
Not that I can think of. I mean I thought it was really fun doing like the Lesbian Gay Center, and you know, I mean, definitely I would say some people would disagree with me, but I thought, you know, the university provided us a fair amount of assistance in, like, getting that accomplished and, like, helping us pave, like, the way into getting, like, the SUFEC funding and stuff. And, you know, not that it was, you know, all, like, you know, green lights ahead, but I didn't really think dealing with, like, you know, the SUFEC people and stuff like that was super complicated. Obviously, probably a bit more complicated than what I considered, considering what happened after the fact. But no, I mean, I think, you know, we, you know, like, after all the planning stuff and thing, we ended up, I thought, with, like, a great board of directors. We had really good working relationships with, like, all the residence halls, the dean of students' office. We were, like, in and out of the student government and the multicultural center all the time. And, you know, we didn't actually at that time try to quantify it. I mean, we quantified other things, but we didn't actually try to quantify how we managed to create, like, these bonds with other organizations and, like, how strong those bonds had grown. But I thought we actually had really good relationships with organizations we wouldn't naturally have had great relationships for if you were, like, just thinking about it. It's like, you know, why would the Lesbian and Gay Campus Center have any type of relationship with, like, the Black Student Association? You know, I mean, that's, like, you know, it's one of those things that's just kind of like, it's a bond that obviously you have to, like, you have to work on. There has to be some type of, like, extension, like, self-extension kind of going out there and, like, you know, maybe, like, a little bit of persuasion, but just, you know, sometimes just, like, a certain amount of stability, like, in terms of, like, not pestering them too much, but not going too far away. Yeah. And they're like, here, it's like, you again. Yeah. you know, because it's like, you know, a lot of the student color organizations didn't have anything to do with the 10% society, you know, like they were those white rebel rousers that were always out there protesting this, doing this kissing, doing that sit-in, doing a die-in,
right.
You know, and then they had those dances.
Yeah.
So, you know, I mean, I thought, you know, in terms of, like, building alliances and kind of really, like, working on relationships. And, I mean, for me, I thought we had actually gotten to a point where we really had created this culture of, like, not really progressive organizations, but disenfranchised organizations that, like, we all, you know, it got to the point where it's like, oh, we can all work together, even if we don't really like so-and-so or so-and-so. You know, it was, like, all of a sudden, like, you start noticing that, like, you know, the BSA events actually have more co-sponsors, where it, like, really used to be, like, you know, the, I forget what the department's called, like the African Studies,
right.
Studies Department and the BSA and the Multicultural Center. That was typically all their events. Those were the three, like, sponsors. But then all of a sudden it's like, you know, after, you know, like a year or so, all of a sudden you see it's like, you know, there's like the Lesbian Gay Center on it, or like this Campus Women's Center, or it's like, or like, you know, even Wunk Chic or something like that. I mean, and poor Wunk Chic, I mean, like, I don't know what they're like now, but like at that period of time, it was just like, I mean, because it was like, Native Americans on campus is like what, less than a percentage of like the population mm-hmm. here mm-hmm. at UW. I mean, and you know, it's like literally they were more of a refuge than a student organization. It was like the 10 of you, and it was like literally the 10 of you. You know, I mean, that was kind of like, that's pretty much it. It's like, we have to import more people in if we're doing like a program, you know?
Right.
But, you know, and like, even though they like shared, well, they actually had their space over there, but like the multicultural center, they have also had like one of like the little tables and stuff in like the back student room at the Multicultural Center, nobody actually included them in any of their programming, mm-hmm. you know? And it was just mm-hmm. like one of those things. It's like, oh, yeah, the Native Americans, you know?
Right. Yeah.
And it was just like, oh, they're just there, you know, and whatnot. And like the only event that I can really recall that they used to do on the regular basis was the, what do they call it? I don't know. It's some fairly big, actually, I don't know if they still do it, but it used to be this kind of like all these Native American dance type of thing where like mm-hmm. they would bring like mm-hmm. people in from like a couple of the different reservations here in like Wisconsin or in Minnesota or something like that. Mm-hmm. And it was actually a pretty cool event, but it was like that one event per year, they imported most of the Native Americans mm-hmm. to come to it. And then like, you know, a lot of the, you know, like a lot of the community people would come in to like purchase like pottery and like beads mm-hmm. and stuff like that. But hardly any students would come to it besides right. like the Native American students. And, you know, I mean, I don't think it was just us, but like we definitely started like working with them. I mean, we made like the second year of the People of Color Speaker Series, we made it a point to bring in a Native American, you know, woman as part of the Speaker Series mm-hmm. and, like, to get mm-hmm. them on board for that. Like, we, like, it's like, you know, they're, you know, we started promoting, like, you know, it's like, this is coming up, you have to do it, you know, like, not have to, you know, it's not yeah. like we're, like, forcing everybody, but it was kind of like, come on, it'll be fun, you know.
Right.
We'll go mm-hmm. there, we'll hit the barber's closet afterwards, you know. You know, it's like, you just tag the barber's closet onto it at the end, you know. You know, and then once their name started appearing on other stuff, like, you know, then all of a sudden, like, oh, it's like all the other student organizations that they shared a room with, it's like, oh, well, maybe you can help co-sponsor this event and stuff.
Right,
I mean, so, like,
right.
I think, you know, I mean, so I do think we kind of made that kind of difference. I mean, because we were fairly gung-ho about, like, well, I see no reason why we shouldn't work with you.
Right.
You know, well, with the exception of, like, the, you know, the very ardent Christian association. But,
right.
But, like, in terms of, like, student of color organizations, like the people with disability organizations. I mean, like Joe and I used to like just go and seek them out. It's like, what? There's like a student with disability organization? It's like, let's go to a meeting.
Yeah,
you know?
Definitely.
You know? And it's like, yeah, you know, we have a couple books. It's like, yeah. And then we're like, sometimes it was like, you know, little white lies because then like afterwards yeah. we're like 9 a.m. at the bookstore. Like, now we have a couple books, you know?
Quick, get some books!
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
But, you know, so I don't know. I mean, I think from our, like, generation of the Lesbian and Gay Campus Center, I mean, I think that was one of the things that we were good at. Like, we were really good at, like, kind of pulling, like, the other campus organizations together, at least in terms of, like, them thinking about working together or like strategically being strategic, even if you don't really like the organization mm-hmm. and stuff. It's like, you know, because it's like, you know, you're not always gonna like everybody. Sometimes you just like, if you're close enough on the same side, you just kind of need to work mm-hmm. together. Mm-hmm. So I think that was our forte.
Absolutely. Sounds like you did it.
So outside of that, no, I can't think of anything. I mean, I don't know if you have any, I can only remember some of the original board and stuff like that, so I don't know if you have any questions about.
Yeah, well,
that.
I mean, if you, Well, I mean, if you have any, if you have any names of people you think would be great, would be good for us to talk to from that time, then that would be good for me to be able to go back and see if they're already on the list, and if they're not, try to get in contact with them.
Well, I can tell you that the people I remember, none of them are still in Madison.
Okay.
So mm-hmm. I don't know if that matters to you.
I mean, I'm not. I'm just a volunteer, so I'll let them decide whether they want to do like phone interviews or something.
Right. So yeah. I mean, our original board, obviously Janice Shepherd, and I don't know if she's on your list, but I mean, and she's still part of the UW system, but I don't think she's here in Madison anymore. So she was our representative from the dean of students' office, and then of course Dean Mary Rouse was the dean back then. God, in terms of like some of the members of the board, there was a David Wilcox. I don't know what the hell David happened Wilcox. To him.
We'll see if we can track him down.
I'm trying to think. Tiffany Newby. She's in San Francisco. Just got back from London, I think, a couple years ago or a year ago or so. Let's see. Juan's dead. Deborah Bay, she's in Washington, D.C. We still talk. I don't really still talk to Tiffany, but I do kind of keep track of her. We like send like the random email, like, you know, or something like that. Ray Hernandez, I don't know what the hell happened to him. He was in Chicago because he did art. Vesmian Gay Art or something like that. He was in Chicago, then I think he was in Mexico for a while, and I don't know if he ever came back from Mexico or whatnot. I'm trying to think of who else. There was a Tori something her name. She was the director of the Campus Women's Center. I don't know what her last name was. Sorry.
Oh, that's fine.
There's two people I'm totally spacing.
That's cool.
Yeah, so.
No, but yeah, these will be some good people for me to, I'll give them their names and we'll see if they want to give them a call and see if they might be interested in talking about that time. But thank you very much. I'm just going to go ahead and stop this here.
Okay.